The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Joining me on the program is Professor Didier Sornay. He holds the Chair of Entrepreneurial Risk at ETH Zurich. He's also the author of a book on the stock market, Crises and Crashes. Stock Markets Crash, Critical Events and Complex Financial Systems. And Professor, can you give us a little bit of an overview of what you're working on at ETH and how this applies, let's say, to the area that I cover, which is finance and the markets?
Yes, so the general background is that we are trying to understand extreme events, which I call dragon kings. So in a variety of fields, this applies, of course, to financial markets, because the financial markets, as you know, are rocked by crashes, by flash crashes nowadays with high-frequency trading, by a lot of turbulence and turmoil. But it also applies to other fields like epileptic seizures in the brain or earthquakes in your region, of course, or material failure and so on and so forth. So this is what we are trying to do, is to understand the underlying mechanism for these extreme events to unravel, and also to develop methodologies based on scientific theory that would allow us to diagnose the drift, the maturation towards these events, so to get some predictability.
Well, this brings up a second question. Why is it difficult to predict complex phenomenon like a stock market crash or a financial crisis after the 2007 crisis and even the 2001 crisis? Even Fed Chairman Greenspan's contention has been, well, we didn't see the bubble. So he contends you can't see these things coming. Do you believe that's a valid assumption?
I disagree. Actually, we saw it coming in 2000. We even documented it. And I think this has to do with what kind of, let's say, variables or what kind of indicators people look at. And this is a very nice illustration of this point. During the run-up from the recovery of the crisis of 2001 until 2007-2008, you know, that led to the Great Recession, you remember that the common wisdom was called the Great Moderation. It's a word that has been popularized by Bernanke, Chairman Bernanke, summarizing the idea or the belief that the economic beast has been tamed, in a sense, because indeed GDP in the U.S. was solid, with very little unpredictability, and unemployment was on the downward slope with also very little volatility, and same thing for the stock market and other indicators. So everything looked like calm, quiet, predictable, and so on. And in this context, the crisis came as a big surprise, like a wrath of God, if you like. But the point that is becoming clear from my own research is that these were the wrong indicators to look at. The correct indicators was the what we can call the exuberance of valuation worldwide, I mean globally, on essentially all asset classes, exhibiting complete unsustainable behavior. We call them super exponential behavior associated with positive feedback, procyclicality. So we were able also to diagnose this on a very different set of metrics.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you go back to 1999 and let's say the year 2000, even ourselves, we got rid of our technology stocks in December because, you know, you had companies that had virtually no sales and earnings, and they were being valued at $5 and $6 billion. You had companies like Cisco that were worth almost $500 billion. So were those the kind of metrics that fit into the kind of exuberance where the public and Wall Street is saying, look, you can't look at valuations, you can't look at this, you just got to keep paying higher prices because we're in a new era?
Yeah, this is a new economy thinking. But the problem is that this new economy thinking is recurrent. You may remember, or at least read, that in the Wall Street Journal in the 1920s, especially in the 1929, that was exactly the same wording, the new economy, based at that time on utilities, you know, telephone, cars, electricity, which was fueling, which was the buzz of the time, justifying apparently the skyrocketing price with the belief that this would change forever the way, you know, the economies would develop. And of course, the crash came as a surprise to the, let's say, less than smart money. The smart money, like yourself, actually saw it coming and went out of the market before October 1929. But the same new economy thinking was also all over the press, in the media and so on, in 1962, associated with the tronic boom. Again, you know, a new large wave of innovation in the electronic sector, and the same new economic thinking, as you mentioned, referred to, was also accompanying the internet. And what we do is essentially add a quantitative layer to the analysis that you were referring to in terms of price over earning and things like that, to look at the non-sustainability. So to put analysis on the dynamics. So we look not only at fixed numbers, let's say what could be, you know, the beauty, so to speak, of a company at a given time, but we look at the unfolding, the time evolution of the different characteristics over the last, let's say, 2-3 years to characterize whether this trajectory has a growth which is sustainable or not sustainable.
So as you look at this, you can see this kind of thing developing. And I was always amazed when we took a look at valuations back either in the year 99, 2000, or even in 2007 and 2008, where even real estate valuations were thrown aside, because anytime Wall Street or a particular industry says, don't pay attention to price, you know that's a warning. And what I'd like to do is talk about these complex systems that seem to be unpredictable. How does your work and research refute this in the way that, in other words, if you can provide a model or a system that people can look at, then it can be applied to, let's say, future crashes and overvaluation?
Let me try to clarify the situation about the predictability of complex systems, because I think there is a lot of misconception about this. Most of us, or most of your auditors, have heard about the butterfly effect. You know, the story that in a chaotic system, the flap of the wings of a butterfly, let's say in Texas, can give rise to a tornado in Thailand, let's say. So this is illustrating the extraordinary impact of a tiny perturbation that can cascade and get amplified later on, giving rise to events of unknown proportion, which might or might not occur. So according to this wisdom, it looks like chaotic and complex systems are utterly unpredictable. But actually, what is forgotten is that this is a predictability about the micro level, the details. It turns out, in particular for meteorology, that there is a higher level of predictability that is concerned with what is called the coherent structures. For example, the large-scale circulation patterns around the globe. And we know scientifically that they have a coherence by their name, a persistence, a predictability that can extend to months. So on one hand, you see, we should not have the tree hide the forest. That on one hand, indeed, in the details, in the small scale, we can have loss of predictability, but large scale, at a coarse grain kind of, let's say, bird's view of a process, we can recover predictability. And this is, I think, the key to understand complex systems and their predictability, is to find the right level of description, the right scale where predictability can still occur. And the second point I should make in answering your question is that many systems, I believe, might be predictable to some degree, or might exhibit some degree of predictability by recording the slow process accumulating in the system. So through a kind of creep, if I take an analogy with material science, you know, creep is a process when you apply a stress, just a weight, for example, on a piece of concrete or wood or plastic, And then apparently you see nothing, but internally there are micro damage. There are slight reconfiguration of the system that can go on for days, weeks, years. And then suddenly, apparently out of the blue, the system will crack, will rupture, or will fall out of the shelf and so on. But actually, if you monitor the right thing, you can see the progressive maturation towards the instability coming.
So let's talk about the institute that you work at and the kind of work that you do, especially getting back to your book that you wrote earlier about these crashes. How successful have you been in predicting them, number one? And number two, as you survey the markets today, where we have central banks providing a lot of liquidity, money is chasing the best kind of returns it can find globally, whether it's in junk bonds, emerging market bonds, or stocks. What does your work tell you about the markets today?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so we have been pretty successful. I mean, I'm very happy with the track record. So to be clear, there are not bubbles and crashes of large proportion every day, right? So on that level, for the big events, the track record with ex ante prediction is necessarily limited to, you know, the event that unfolded in the last 15 years when we started really to become operational. So, for example, in 1998, the Russian crisis for us was actually predictable. We get out of the market before the crash. It was clearly developing with a component of endogeneity. It was not just, you know, the Russian default that cascaded in the U.S. and German market in particular, but there was also an overheating of the market that was clearly understandable and could be detected in advance. Similarly, for the internet.com bubble that crashed in 2000, we saw very clearly the bubble on real estate market coming, and we published in advance in 2005 a prediction that the peak of the real estate market in the U.S. would be mid-2006. Which turns out to be very good. We analyzed also the bubble developing on oil that culminated in July 2008, also with an advance warning that was published in an international archive. So we have this kind of track record also on Chinese market and so on, with on the massive bubbles. So we have a few errors, like in October 1997, I really believed that the crash was coming at the time. That was our early attempt, and it did not come. Until, you know, another year in August, September 1998. But what happened is the volatility skyrocketed. And I remember with a professor, one of my colleagues at UCLA in there, and the Sunov of Management, we were actually buying put option betting on the crash. And we made 400% just in one day, just on the volatility. But we continued to get in, to be invested betting on the crash that did not occur. What did occur, however, was a change of regime because the market plateaued for 3-4 months before rising again. And this allows me, by the way, to mention that in our theory, we never predict crash. We try to diagnose the end of bubbles, namely a change of regime. And that's very different because a bubble can burst in very different ways. So we have also developed a lot of experiments on what I call smaller bubbles that develop over a 6-month time scale. And for which, of course, the change of regime is less dramatic. So correction between 10-15%. And we have put the track record on our website. So everybody can check this. And all these are ex ante processes, ex ante predictions. So we don't do ex post, you know, back testing. We do real time experiment. We even actually develop a real implementation with, I put aside 100,000 Swiss francs to actually test the predictability on real money, and it works very well. Now, on the second part of your question, which is where are we going and what do we see now? So the first point I want to make is that we are still, in my opinion, in our analysis, in a hangover phase of a massive set of bubbles that I, in our analysis, I see going back all the way to the early 1980s. So the way we should understand the present time is the, so to say, let's say a recuperation or digestion of a massive set of bubbles, essentially 7 bubbles, like the bubble that collapsed in October 1987, then the ICT internet bubble, the real estate bubble in the U.S., but also worldwide in many other countries, the stock market bubble that started to regime in October 2007, commodity bubbles, oil bubbles, credit bubble, debt bubble, financial instrument bubble. So all these were enormous excesses that developed in a kind of perpetual money machine, allowing us overall as a society to consume more than we gain, extracting value out of a virtual universe, which, of course, now is no more functioning. I mean, it's a part of course, is functioning. So what we see from our Financial Crisis Observatory is intermittent bubbles that come, that are inflated by investors who are in search of return. It's very difficult, of course, as a situation now with a zero interest rate policy to get return. And we see this kind of herding, this kind of attraction to the buzz of the time. So we saw, for example, in 2010, 2011, great attraction to silver, to gold, to the Swiss franc. And these were very nice bubbles, according to our methodology. We were able to time them, to trade on them, to predict them very, very accurately. And in the future, for example, we see now that the U.S. market, by the way, is overvalued and may change regime in the next few months. We saw this on the Nasdaq, on the Russell, on biotech, and so on. We see reversely an opportunity for some commodities, like gold, for example, that has been abandoned in the last 2 years after a great surge. We think, according to our signal, that it may actually rebound and change regime again. And there are also other opportunities on emerging market. We saw, for example, a clear change of regime in April, May 2013 for Japan and other countries, where it's very interesting to continue to survey what is the future development in these countries.
So from what you're viewing, we may be nearing a reflection point, let's say in U.S. stocks, in a reversal in the downturn in, let's say, the gold and silver market, which, I mean, if you look at the gold and silvers, the metals themselves since 2011, and then also look at the stocks, they've been devastated, almost like what happened to many of the tech stocks between 2000 and 2002.
That's correct. Yeah, you summarized correctly my statement.
Well, thank you. Let's distinguish, or can you explain the power law and how this relates to your concept of the Dragon King?
Yes. So we should be clear, because power law is a term that is used for everything, in particular for the fat tail or heavy tail distribution of returns. The type of power law that we are using is totally different because it does not describe the statistics of the risks in terms of the frequency of losses of a given size. It rather corresponds to this phase that I call super exponential non-sustainable growth resulting from positive feedback. So in a nutshell, it's a set of mathematical description or and equations that describe the fact that the higher the price, the higher the demand. So that the rate of return, so the rate of growth of a price, the return, is no more constant but grows itself. So you know, everything in economics and finance investment is about compounding interest, which means that if you have, let's say, a 10% return first year and a 10% return the next year and 10% every year, your wealth will grow from 100 to 110, 121, and then will grow exponentially by the strength of this compounding of interest. This is the standard exponential growth of a constant rate of return. What we see in transition period where bubbles develop is that the rate of return increases itself. So we go through phases like 5% the first year, 10% next year, 20%, 40%, 80%, and so on. To give an example, concrete example, just in the 2 years before the crash on the internet bubble, in just 2 years, the Nasdaq component, the internet component of the Nasdaq, grew by 1,100%, by a factor 11, so just 2 years. And it did that not at a constant rate of return, but at an accelerating rate of return, which like, for example, 20% the first year or first 3 months, then 40%, then 80%, and then accelerating. And this is what we are able to detect very precisely. So this is the core of the theory to characterize the positive feedback mechanism, which are either from a behavioral perspective, imitation, herding, which may be irrational, actually, but also can be technical, like risk hedging, arbitraging, portfolio insurance, margin requirement, policy, and so on. So this is what we capture, positive feedback.
Can you distinguish the difference between something that is commonly referred to as a black swan and, let's say, a dragon king? What's the difference between the two?
Yes, very clear. So black swan is the popular incarnation, if I may, of what Professor Knight, Chicago School economist in 1930, introduced, and what is called now the Nassian uncertainty, or the unknown unknown. The fact that we may live through events which we did not have any idea that they were possible. For most Americans, an example of such a black swan or a night event would be September 11, where for most Americans, you believed that, you know, an attack of this magnitude on the American territory was inconceivable. And then it happened, and then it changed your view of the world. Of course, the CIA and the Pentagon knew about it, but for most of people, it would be a black swan or a night event. So these kind of events are, by definition, unknown and unknowable, and there's not much you can do against them. Just prepare yourself for the fact that something can happen, can fall on yourself from the sky, that you have no idea. And that's, of course, a very pessimistic view of the world, because it means that you cannot do science about it, you cannot insure yourself, you cannot prepare, or you have to prepare in a very robust and targeted way. The Dragon King concept, at the opposite, claims that most extreme events are actually knowable. It's just a question of looking at the right diagnostic, the right metrics. And I claim that most of the extreme events, those of which we have mentioned during our discussion, actually proceed not through, you know, a wrath of God or a surprise, but through this progressive maturation toward instability, a progressive damage, a progressive build-up of processes that help the trigger of the events when the system is ripe. It's like, you know, when a fruit falls from the tree. Of course, you can have a big surprise if there is a hurricane hitting the tree and will get the fruit out of the branches, whatever the ripeness of the fruit. But most of the time, the fruit falls because it has ripened. And so this is the key idea. Dragon kings emerge as a result of a progressive maturation towards instability. And I repeat this sentence because it is key to understand the predictability of this event. And I use the term dragon kings for a very specific reason. In economics, there is the notion of the Pareto distribution after the famous Italian economist in 1896. He introduced this empirical observation that the distribution of wealth of people in UK or in Italy is this Pareto distribution. But in some countries, you have what is called the king effect. So, for example, you take Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or other countries, or in the Middle Age, the king or the king family own a finite fraction of the whole wealth of the country, like 50% of the total wealth. So you had this power distribution describing the wealth of all the people, and you had this singularity, this unique family, the king, which would be completely outside the family, the whole distribution. So that's the key idea. The Dragon King is an event which goes out of the ordinary. It goes out of the ordinary because it's result from this special instability which is maturing the system and makes it happen in a very specific way.
As you look at the world today, what do you see as the biggest risk facing the financial system today?
First, so it's a very interesting question, of course, and I'm continuously thinking about it and trying to understand better this. So I rather think about this problem in terms of scenarios first, and also by recognizing that nowadays, more than ever before, the risks are not monodimensional, but are linked, are entangled. For example, in 1923, the great earthquake destroyed Tokyo in Japan. Nobody cared in the rest of the world, except the Japanese, because Japan was essentially decoupled from the rest of the world economically and so on. Now, this earthquake is bound. We know it will come back. We don't know when, The typical time for a recurrence is about 70 years, so it's due, but with a plus or minus uncertainty of 70 years. When it will happen, we know that even with the best engineering construction of the Japanese, a significant part of Tokyo will be destroyed, which is one-third to one-half the production capacity of Japan. Japan holds still $1.1 trillion of the U.S. Treasury bond. And we know, and many studies have shown, that it will lead to a significant global recession in the world because the Japanese will have to sell the bond to reconstruct and so on. So there will be a severe recession, cascading. So this is just an example of the linkage that we are now looking. And this is not just finance and natural hazard. It's everywhere, pandemics, economics, geopolitics, oil, and so on. So I see more the vulnerability coming from the growing globalization. If you want me to cite a single threat, I would say the threat is more endogenous than exogenous. So it's the threat that we are building ourselves with the destruction of our environment, the sensitivity to, let's say, the global pandemics, something like this. And of course, the financial vulnerability that is still enormous. And now, as you know, finance is the tail that wags the dogs. So it's no more the servant of the economy, it's the queen that controls everything. And this is very clear in the way the central bank, the treasury secretaries, and the different governments try to court finance in order to get still access to funding and to keep the status quo.
Has the process of globalization made these risks or enhanced these risks in any way? In other words, our markets are so interconnected. And if you take technology and information, there's not an event that can happen any place in the world today where it's not going to be instantaneously reflected in the news services. Traders around the globe are all looking at the same charts. So you have this instant reaction to an event. So does this heighten the kind of dragon king that you're talking about, or black swans, because it's so interconnected and there's such a large pool of money?
Yes. So in one way, globalization gives rise to diversification, surprisingly, for the small risk or the medium-sized risks. Indeed, if you think of a company, an international company, which is highly diversified in many different types of business, the fact that one branch doesn't do so good is compensated by the other branch. So globalization has very strong benefits. But there is a dark side of these benefits, which is while the small and medium-sized risks are decreased by this diversification process, the extreme risks are enhanced. And this is something that is very clear from models that not us only, but many, many groups around the world, many academics in particular, have developed to show this duality, this dark side coming with a white side. The fact that firewalls do not exist anymore. So we are more vulnerable to what can be called a runaway when the size of the event is such that nothing can stop it and then it invades the whole system. A very good example, which is close to you in California, is coming from the policy of stopping fires. And this is actually, I'm borrowing from a study that were done by a professor at the University of Irvine, who demonstrated that by the policy of stopping all fires in Southern California, the result was a great stopping of all the fires, except those conflagrations that occur when the Santa Ana wind blows from the desert, and when after several years of successfully stopping all fires, this enormous amount of fuel, of dead wood that accumulated, and gives the conflagration, which is so large that no human power, no planes, helicopter, and firefighters can stop. So you see the duality of this that always come into these processes. So indeed, in a way, the dragon kings become more larger and more serious due to this globalization.
You know, you wrote a paper back a couple of years ago. It was called The Illusion of the Perpetual Money Machine. And in it, you include a chart where you model, or your model predicts, U.S. debt to GDP crashing around the year 2020. Has there been any changes to that model, and what do you think this means for the global economy, and how did you arrive at that conclusion?
Yes, actually, that was just last year. We released this study, if I remember correctly, December 2012. So it's very timely still. So first, a correction. It's not a crash that we predict. As I said, we diagnose bubbles, and we try to diagnose the end of bubbles, the end that announces a change of regime. So that's the claim, that indeed the depth of the U.S. is galloping, is accelerating, and we can actually reverse the statement saying the benefit of any additional dollar of debt in terms of increasing GDP of the U.S. is going asymptotically to zero, with a turning point which is very close, actually. We don't know exactly. We found a time between 2015 and 2020 because the precision is very difficult to assess, and of course it's vulnerable to policy changes and so on. But we are very close to that time where any additional debt will be trying to keep the status quo and will actually be ineffective anymore. So we are really very close to a change of regime, and yes, our conclusion holds.
Well, listen, Professor, if our listeners would like to follow your work and the things that you write about, the work that you're doing on trying to predict these things, how could they do so?
Yes, so I have a website, and you're welcome to communicate it, where we put all our writing, the papers, the methodology, and so on. And we have also a part on this website which is dedicated to the Financial Crisis Observatory. For example, this paper you mentioned on the illusion of the perpetual money machine can be downloaded at this website. And we are going to revive our monitoring of the 25,000 of assets worldwide, of which, of course, the U.S. stock market is a big constituent of it. We are going to release a part of this. We are right now actually on a time where the platform is fully functional. And as I'm speaking to you, I'm looking at the charts, and we're looking at the charts in order to answer to some of your questions. But we are right now deciding what we should release open source to the public because, of course, of issues of liabilities and responsibilities and also in terms of communication. So we are certainly going to put things live, which are more macro signals that could be helpful. And we are, of course, open to any contact and any personal. So if any of your auditors want to contact me and my group, they are welcome to do so.
Okay. And your website?
www.er4entrepreneurrisk.eth for ETH, the name of the Federal Institute of Technology, .ch for Switzerland.
Well, listen, Professor, it was a pleasure having you on the program. Last time we spoke is when your book came out, right after the big crash that occurred at the beginning of the last decade, the bursting of the internet bubble. And we appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure, and I thank you for your very penetrating questions.
Well, that concludes my interview with Didier Sornay. And once again, he wrote a book about crashes. I interviewed him about a little over a decade ago. This was right after the downturn or the bursting of the tech bubble. And of course, his book back then was called Stock Market Crash, Critical Events in Complex Financial Systems. Now, he talked about a couple things here that I think were real key. And what I really wanted him to do was to distinguish between black swan events like, let's say, 9/11, and what he calls his Dragon Kings. And black swans are things that appear out of nowhere. Think of the tsunami, the earthquake that triggered Fukushima. And those are the things that you just can't see. You can't see them coming. You can't predict them. They are black swans. The Dragon King, and the concept he's trying to get here, the Dragon King is an event, let's take the financial markets, where you can look, if you analyze the right data. He talked about the stock market crash, the exuberance. Think of the way companies were being valuated back in the late 90s. I can remember analysts coming out and say, well, you can't analyze that company on earnings and sales, even though they have it. They got eyeball clicks. I mean, you get this kind of ridiculous stuff. The exuberance, the overvaluation, the idea that, well, it doesn't matter what price that you're paying, there's going to be some fool behind you that's going to pay even more. You just don't get it. And those are the kind of things when you see them starting to occur, give way, to what he calls the Dragon King in these type of crashes. What I thought was interesting is you remember going back to, let's say, September of 2011, we had gotten QE indications coming out of Jackson Hole that we were going to have more quantitative easing. And of course, that lit up the gold markets. Silver had already hit a peak in April of that year at almost $50 an ounce. And then gold got up to $1,900. And after going up year after year after year, once again, you get into that exuberance phase. Well, there's nothing else that this thing can do but go up. Well, it didn't. It didn't go up. It crashed. Not only did gold crash, it went from over 1900 down to 1100. Silver went down to in the teens from 50. That's not a pullback. That's not a healthy correction. That's a crash. That's a bear market. And of course, gold stocks got beaten up. I thought it was interesting that he saw that we could be building up into a mini bubble here in the market, but he also said a turnaround in the gold stocks and bullion. And I think that may come with policy with the Yellen Fed. If you take a look at some of these gold stocks, they've been beaten up. Well, beaten up. They've been taken out into the woodshed would be a better word to describe it. There may be some opportunities coming up here in something that has been unloved, unliked for the last couple of years. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.